Welcome to Counter Stories, podcast for people of color, by people of color, and everybody else. My name is Luz Maria Frias. I'm the founder and CEO of The Savvy Coach, where we provide executive coaching.
Halee Lee, I'm the owner of the Other Media Group.
Donald Eubanks, associate professor and cultural consultant.
Anthony Galloway, senior partner at Dendros Group.
And I'm Marianne Combs. I'm a reporter and producer at NPR News.
Well, folks, this is yet another episode that we are recording from the shelter-in-place restrictions where we are recording from home. And while it is always wonderful to connect with each of you, we also find ourselves in a painful moment in our lives with each other and our community, given the sadness that we know that, Don, you're going through with the loss of your mother, yet another loss attributed to COVID-19. And we want to give you some time to connect on that with us and tell us what's on your mind, Don.
Yeah, thanks, Luz. I thought this would be easy. You know, those of us who listen to Counter Stories may have noticed that I wasn't part of the group with the last recording. That was due to the fact that my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. We were notified on April 3rd, and I think it was right around the time that during one of the governor's briefings, they mentioned that they were going to release the names of healthcare facilities where higher rates of COVID had been impacting our community. And the evening before they released the names of those facilities, they contacted my sister, who has the power of attorney for my mother, to notify my sister that the facility where my mom was located had two confirmed cases of COVID. So my sister immediately notified all my siblings. The place where she's at is not that large. There's a couple of wings to it. There's a common area, and then there's a smaller area where they all eat together, but they're all together, and then they sleep in these kind of two separate wings. And so the news that there was two confirmed cases in there is scary, because you hear of COVID hitting these facilities, and you have all this emotion that rushes through you because your mother is a vulnerable adult. You think they would be safe in a healthcare facility, but I don't think it's any different than what our citizens are experiencing, those who are like locked away in prisons. You know, they can't go anywhere. So to receive this information, you try not to freak out, but you know it's not good, right? But at that time, you know, my mother was fine. They notified us that, you know, her temp was fine. She would, you know, everything was fine. Well, on the 9th, they called and said that my mother had developed a temperature, so that they decided to move her from her regular wing, because now with the other two confirmed cases, they had created a wing where they were keeping the patients who had COVID and then everyone else in a separate wing. Saturday, they contacted my sister again to ask whether or not she could be tested for COVID. And so my sister gave them the approval to test her for COVID. So we had a video conference with my mother on Monday. They hadn't notified us about the test. But at this point in time, my mother is resting well, but they informed us that she hadn't been eating a lot. She hadn't been taking in a lot of fluids. And so while she's resting well and everything, she's slowly starting to go downhill. And with Alzheimer's, eventually they stop eating. They just kind of forget that they need to eat. Well, later that evening, my sister got back in touch with us to notify us that the test results came back and my mother was positive. So up until that point in time, we knew she had a slight fever, but we were holding hope that, you know, she didn't have COVID. So that was kind of devastating. I mean, I was in shock. So they move my mother to isolation. So my sister attempts to set up some video conferences. Some are successful, others aren't. But the facility was doing a pretty good job of at least notifying my sister. So that Monday, she tested positive. The following day, the facility wanted to know if it was all right if we could approve my mother to be switched to hospice. I guess I was in shock that in a matter of days, my mother was going from having her vitals being fine to now the facility was requesting to put her on hospice. And, you know, hospice carries kind of a certain meaning to that, which didn't escape me. And so, you know, that happened on Tuesday, the 14th. We had a couple of video conferences with my brothers and sisters, with my mom. By this point in time, she's lying there. She's not really responding to us on the video conference. I mean, you know, she's there, but she's not there. During that time, you're just kind of in shock, disbelief. We're hoping for the best that, you know, she's going to pull through this. During this entire time, they're taking her temp. Her temp would be like 99.2. It wasn't high or anything and gave us hope. But that Sunday, the 18th, you know, by now we're starting to notify people. We weren't really sharing the COVID diagnosis, just sharing what was happening with her. But we did with our close immediate family. So my uncle was on a video conference with us. He said a prayer for my mother in Ojibwe in preparation. That was Sunday. I'm kind of an early riser. Ever since I worked at Mille Lacs, and I used to have to get up at 5 in order to be there by 8 o'clock in the morning. So Monday morning around 5, and I hear the phone in the kitchen ring. And my immediate thought was, that's not good. It stopped ringing, and then all of a sudden my cell phone rang. Call me on my cell phone. So I knew it was my sister. And it was my sister calling to tell me that my mom had passed. So excuse me.
Take your time.
So I thought I would be able to get through this. So I guess that kind of describes some of the emotions during this period. Because life goes on and, you know, this is all tied together with what's happening in our communities. You know, was it COVID that killed my mother? I can't say that it was. I'm not even sure how my mother was classified. Did she add to the growing numbers of COVID-related deaths? I really don't know one way or the other, but my guess would be yes. We got her death certificate, and it says she died of natural causes. But then underlying circumstances, the first thing that's listed is COVID-19. Even though they told us she had tested positive, a part of you wants to believe that that was not real. You know what I mean? It can't be real. But it was on her death certificate. And was it COVID? Was it Alzheimer's? I think, you know, all these things come together. What I can say, what COVID did do is it prevented us from being able to see her. It prevented us from being there with her during this time. That's what COVID did. I also have to say that I have nothing but gratitude for the healthcare workers who work in these facilities. My heart goes out to them. Our regular frontline healthcare workers who work in these facilities, who are underpaid, many of whom are immigrants, many of them who are foreigners, and we know we don't pay these individuals well. And I couldn't help but marvel at the strength and the braveness of these workers to be willing to go into the room with my mother, who's tested positive for COVID, with a computer so that we could video conference with her. I mean, think of the bravery of these individuals to do that, to help bring us comfort that are jeopardizing their own safety and their family's safety. I mean, I have nothing but gratitude for these individuals. But to deal with the anger of having to deal with the fact that your mom is in a facility you think would be safe, and we're out here trying to remain safe, and the one person you would think should be safe is the person who comes down with COVID. Your emotions are all over the place. I mean, half the time I was pissed. I was angry at the system. I was angry at the facility, but that's misguided. You know, they didn't bring this on her. But you're sad, you're grieving, you're fearful. My mother is dying, and since I'm in the high-risk category, how do I reconcile the grief of not being able to see my mother coupled with the fear of being anywhere close to her? How do you reconcile that? You know, and then I think about the COVID deaths throughout the world, let alone just here in the United States. And you feel this compassion for all the families who've had to deal with people who have passed from COVID. I hear horrifying stories of countries digging mass graves to dump these bodies in. My mother's body was whisked away to the funeral that very same day. We were notified that because she had COVID, we could not see her, that her body would be put in a coffin and immediately buried. Well, that happened 2 days after she passed. We were at least able to drive up to the cemetery, which is where her father, some of her brothers and sisters, and her close immediate family are all buried in a small cemetery right by where my grandfather lived. We were at least able to drive up and watch as they pulled her coffin out of the back of the hearse and immediately put it in the ground, covered it up, and that was it. And then we drove back home. In our community, in the American Indian community, there are certain traditions that we have, and when someone passes and begins their journey, you know, 3-4 days later, there's a wake, there's a ceremony. She's sent off on her journey. In our culture, the journey takes 3 or 4 days. There's a communal feast. I mean, there's a gathering of the community. None of that happened. And so, you know, you're dealing with the grief of your mother passing, but then also the grief of not being able to have the ceremony where community comes together. We're hoping that once this thing passes, we may have a time where we can come together, not just as an immediate family, because we haven't even been able to do that. Even with my brothers and sisters, I waved to them from my car to their car. We couldn't even get out of our cars. And so it's not that I feel sorry for myself or anything like that. I just can't imagine all these families throughout the world that are dealing with this. So, you know, what COVID did, whether or not it killed my mother, is that it prevented us from being with her. And I think that is probably one of the hardest things to deal with, not to be able to deal with it and not to be able to see especially your mother. So thank you for letting me share that.
Don, I think I speak for the entire crew and our loyal listeners. We feel your pain and we're with you and support you. You have painfully illustrated for us the deeper dimensions of what COVID-19 has done in terms of our ability, as you said, to pay your respects to your family, to be unable to be there by her bed as she passed away, to be prohibited and precluded from attending her service, and not being able to share that space with your siblings at the same time. All of that makes this even more difficult than it already is. And as you well said, Don, thinking about how this has played itself out in thousands of numbers across our country and our world further just illustrates the pain that we are experiencing that's unique to this type of pandemic.
To have sat from my cultural space, we've just been honored with being able to hear Don's story and the story of the beginning of his mom's journey. And there are two things happening. One, my predisposition is to hear more about her story so that I can carry her story forward in honor. But then also just to have a place of honoring the fact that we are going to be telling stories like this, unfortunately, as Don has brought up. And we've got to start thinking about how we prepare ourselves to have to tell that story. You know, we just had a scare. We were rushing to Walgreens to get my grandmother, who's in her 80s, medication for what she was telling us was a bad sinus infection. And it ended up with her having to go to do a doctor's visit just to check. And the experience, like, Don, what your story has done is forced me to have to engage with my own family, our conversations about what we are going to do, how we are going to prepare and plan. Because I don't know that I'm in a place of being able to walk through and process not being able to do the things that we do to honor. That breaks my heart into so many different pieces. And to have you courageously share that with us in a way that we can start to prep, that's the question that's on my mind. For y'all right here on this call, I mean, let's be real. How do you prepare? What do you put in place? I'm getting a sense, Don, that I don't know that there are things that can be done to replace that. And I'm just curious about what the planning or thought is around that. Because I just need to know for myself. I need ideas because I don't know.
You know, Anthony, that I shared my story. That's my personal, I guess, story reaction, because I can't talk for my brothers and sisters. You know, I mentioned that my sister, the one right underneath me, my sister had the power of attorney. So she was the contact person. And I feel for my sister because she kind of carried the weight of this on her shoulders. And while we were all present, and while I'm the oldest and I tend to be, you know, the one that things kind of fall on, my sister kind of carried this because she was the one that they would contact. She was the one that kind of set up the video conferences. She was the one who did all this. And for that, I am extremely grateful. Anthony, having gone through, there's nothing you can do to prepare you for the fact that if a loved one contracts COVID, you know, you can't see them. But even having said that, the facility asked if we wanted to come in to see my mother. I couldn't believe it. But because me and most of my other siblings fall in that high risk category, we were all scared to death to go see our mother, with the exception of my younger brother. He went in and they put him in PPE. They put him in a gown, goggles, mask, the whole nine yards. And he sat in that room with my mom for, he said, about an hour. So now I'm concerned that he's fine. You know what I mean? So now I'm worried about my younger brother, on top of worrying about whether or not anyone else in the family is going to contract this disease. But, you know, I think it's something that it forces you, I guess, have those conversations with your family and your loved ones. What are you going to do if something like that happens? But you got to kind of prepare for that. COVID doesn't allow normal passage, normal grieving, normal saying goodbye. It doesn't allow you to do that.
And I thank you for sharing that. And what that does for me, it refocuses back onto, you know, COVID presents something, a whole lot of things that we can't do anything about, especially without a vaccine or medically tested and proven procedures, things like that. But there are a whole lot of things that we can do. And we're all in that space of just doing what we can, right?
My grandmother, who has only one working lung, lives with my parents. And my baby brother, who's had to move in with my sister because he still works. My dad has taken all his vacation for the year. He's the only income maker in the household, with my grandmother being sick and my mother being unable to work because of an injury that she got at her workplace many years ago. So he hasn't gotten his stimulus check, and he's pretty sure that it'll just be for him because my mother is now claimed. So he's down right now. He's expecting he's going to have to go back to work in the next week because he's run out of vacation. Nobody else at his job, and they're deemed essential because they do make products for the healthcare system. No one else at his job seems to be super concerned. And he got yelled at from some of his coworkers because he had put signs on his door that said, like, wash your hands before you come in my office, that kind of stuff. And then they got very offended by the signage that he had up. His concern, obviously, is for my grandmother. He is willing to quarantine himself in the master bedroom while he has to go back to work, because he's afraid of what might happen. We as a family are operating not on what if someone gets it, but what are we going to do when someone contracts COVID. Several of my sisters have houses that have basements that have their own bathrooms, and so we're deeming several of their basement places as quarantine spaces for those who still have to work or those who might contract it. In my household, my husband and I have talked about it. Should one of us contract, or when one of us contracts COVID, as we're both still semi-working, that we're turning his music room into a spare bedroom so that when one of us contracts it, we'll be quarantined into our master bedroom and the other person will just have to bring food up.
Lee, thank you for that. I think it's really smart that you're talking about when, not if. And back to Anthony, I feel like also part of it is it's not just about the what do we do physically? It's about how do we grieve alone? And the fact that we're in a situation where we're going to suffer losses and we can't hold each other. So how do we mentally prepare ourselves for that? How do we take care of each other when we can't hold each other anymore? And that to me is, it just ached on hearing your story and about not being able to be with your mother in those last hours. As somebody who has a very strong relationship with my own mother, who's in her 80s and who's on the other side of the country right now, that really hits home for me. And so, yeah, what do we do? And this is just a question to all of us sitting here. Anthony, we as a culture, we need togetherness to get through hard times. And this is something that's really tearing apart at that ability to be together. And I mean, I love you guys, but a Zoom call doesn't do it.
Mary Ann, you bring up something that's so important. Many of our communities have crafted coping mechanisms over years of trauma and persecution and being pushed to the margins of society. And you develop all of these mechanisms to be hardy and survive and thrive and even turn that into something that you can celebrate and it becomes a new part of identity and culture. And the challenge that I'm facing is those carefully crafted and powerful tools are things that we can't engage right now. And it's a layer that I don't think that we are aware of. And that's true for everybody, right? It's not that it's different for folks of color. It's just that the big picture piece is not different, but the ways, the specificity is different, right? Don, you said, you know, it's a 3-day process. It's a 3-day process in Hmong community, right, Lee? Or is it longer? I'm trying to remember.
It is. During our last recording, Don wasn't able to join us. And I felt the need to bring that up because I knew of the situation that I can't imagine losing one of my parents and not going through the process. Because as much as religion is such a big question mark for myself, I know how important it is for my family and the elders to see that journey through and to make sure that they're on the right journey to where they need to be. It breaks my heart to hear that we're not able to properly send off our elders during this time.
I'm Marianne Combs. You're listening to Counter Stories. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit, but first, let's get a quick update on news headlines. We're back. This is Counter Stories. I'm Marianne Combs, and I'm joined by Luz Maria Frias, Anthony Galloway, Halee Lee, and Don Eubanks.
Well, we talk about structures, Anthony. Certainly our cultures, but also our places of worship that are closely tied to our culture. And not being able to be in community at a place of worship, whatever that structure might be, makes it that much more difficult to grieve and heal. And we know that the healing part of it will be a long journey. But if at the start of that journey, we have some fundamental barriers that allow us to even be a part of what we are accustomed to as a society and as a people, it adds the layers of the stress onto what families and individuals are feeling directly right now as well.
I want to share with you all, so my church community, we're at St. James AME Church in St. Paul, and the Young People's Division organized a mass parade for all of the elders in the church. Well, for many of the elders in the church. We gathered together, decorated our cars, put signs out, couldn't interact with each other, but at least could be in the same street. And then we proceeded to drive from Minneapolis to Burnsville to New Brighton. I mean, folks are spread out, right? All across St. Paul. And the joy on the faces of these elders as they got to stand in front of their house or their assisted living communities and would just honk and wave at them. You know, they're waving their tears. It was like this break of loneliness and all of that. And it felt so good. And at some point, as we started to come back down to having seen all these folks we call pots of gold, I came to the painful realization that it wasn't enough. To Marianne's point about being on Zoom and all these pieces, there's a loneliness that is setting in. I have my family unit and I have friends in my group who we've begged and pleaded just to sit on the other side of our yard with a fire in between us, just because I can't figure out what they're doing in a house by themselves. And so there is not a replacement. The painful challenge that comes up here is, at what point do I say, forget it? I am going to calculate the risk and I'm going to go in, you know, if my grandmother's struggling or, you know what, at this point, I might go and take that risk just to preserve the last contact. Because I can't wrap my head around not being able to do that. And so that has to also be a measure of our public response and a way that we think about how we're doing the things that we're doing. When we're forced to have to go through those things with the added layer of having such deeply tied cultural mechanisms, and then I encounter folks who are flippant or dismissive of the seriousness of what's going on here, and tying it to conspiracy and political views and all these things, where there's real stuff happening on the ground that I get to detach from. It's a mixture of the loneliness because our current processes are not enough, the what ifs, things that I can't do, the worry about grandmother, and then to see folks in the community just dismiss it outright and even line up in groups and protest measures that are proving that we are doing it better than other places. All those things are just pulling me apart right now, and I'm having a hard time keeping cogent thoughts.
Oh my God, I'm so full of anger. Like, you think I'm angry normally? Like, oh my God, my husband keeps trying to, like, he says, water off a duck's back. That's what he says. I need to pick my battles, right? But I get so angry because we're going to such extremes to keep people safe. You know, my grandmother is so lonely with, my grandmother has a Facebook now, and it's literally just her grandkids and her kids posting and sharing photos with her during this time. My dad walks through them with her to show them to her because she can't be around the kids right now. And it breaks my heart. And then I see people just like, oh, the sun's out, which means COVID no longer exists because it just magically goes away or something. I don't want to be that person in my neighborhood who yells at people. But, like, I've yelled at people. I live on the east side of St. Paul. There's a lot of Hmong people here. And I've driven by groups of Hmong people gathered. And they're like, well, we're outside. And our elders are inside. I'm like, yeah, but then you go inside to where your elders are. Do you understand this? Just, like, I'm tired of just being angry at people for being stupid.
We think about the different instances where people are not adhering to the shelter at home and are flagrantly disregarding those orders and expect accountability, right? We expect that we're all in this together, which means we all need to follow the rules, which means we all need to protect each other. And the examples, Anthony, that you alluded to, as well as Halee, I mean, what I think about is the Liberate movement that we have seen not only in Minnesota, but across the country, where you have hundreds of demonstrators out there on either the steps of the Capitol, or in St. Paul, it was the steps of the governor's mansion, protesting. We had over 800 people protest. And there were so many issues that ran through my mind, of course. One is safety, and how is it that you can still demonstrate without a permit, mind you, so they had no permit to demonstrate. There was no immediate repercussions from law enforcement on that issue of not having a permit. There wasn't any repercussion on the issue of violation of the shelter at home order. And then you have the disparate handling of the protesters, meaning there was no riot gear by the law enforcement. There wasn't any carting off of protesters. There weren't any dogs to control the protesters. All that juxtaposed with how when there are demonstrators by African Americans or other brown people, we have a completely different response. We see law enforcement often showing up in riot gear and carting people off.
When they do have permits.
Permits and are unarmed and are, and it's peaceful assembly. Like, there's a whole lot of things to compare and juxtapose.
Well, you know, when I heard that the protest is going to happen in Minnesota, I thought, okay, well, we'll be smart enough. Our governor will be smart enough to say, hey, A, people are starting to get fined for breaking the stay-at-home order. Second, there was no permits. You know, it'll be dispersed or whatever. I saw none of that. I was so disappointed. And I just kept thinking, and I asked this on my social media, I was like, I don't understand why this is happening, right? Like, when Black Lives Matters, when, you know, stopping Line 3, when all of that happens, people are arrested, they're charged. There was a bill introduced for protesters to get 3 years in prison. None of that was happening when these protests were going on for Liberate, quote unquote, Minnesota or whatever. You know, so it's like, okay, you know, I was so confused. And of course, then I just became more angry, just the difference in how people can still not see the difference, right? People are saying, well, this is different than Black Lives Matters. This is different. And I was like, no, it's, you're still protesting. In other states where people were literally showing up with weapons, how is this not, that's all I got. Those are the words I have for this.
I'd just like to add that as a journalist, I'm just worried about my coworkers who need to be out in this, and it's their duty to cover this, especially our photojournalists who are going out to these protests to document them. And I'm just really worried for their health.
Don, I see your face.
Well, the divisiveness in this country right now during a pandemic disappoints me. It angers me, you know, having gone through this experience, as well as, you know, the over 55,000 other Americans who have died during this pandemic and their families and extended families. The misinformation, the disingenuous, I mean, just the anger, the fear. I mean, how do you reconcile all these emotions that are happening at the same time? But, you know, the thing that happened recently involving leadership in our country, because of the misinformation, I stopped paying attention to the president's briefings a couple weeks ago. But, you know, every day, unfortunately, they still show up on my social media feed. And so 2-3 days ago, I started seeing that our president had made comments about UV lights and shining lights injecting, you know, disinfectants and how it kills the virus. And, you know, when I first started seeing those, I thought, no, this can't be real. You know, this has got to be fake news, right? You know, this can't be real. But then legitimate news media started carrying the video of this. It was so incredulous. I couldn't believe that someone would make comments like that. But what made it worse is the next day in the denial that this person was being serious with those comments. And in fact, was doing it sarcastically, was even worse than making the comments up front. Because who sarcastically talks about a virus that has killed over 55,000 Americans, including my mother, and can stand there and tell you he was being sarcastic and not for real? There's a total vacuum in our leadership in this country on the top. And if that was not a clear case of that, of someone who doesn't even have the empathy for the 55,000 Americans who have died in this country and their extended families, I have never felt so much anger and disappointment in the lack of leadership shown for Americans in this country. I'm sorry,
I mean, you're right though, Don, and what Marianne was saying too, with the media having to go out and cover this, when people at the rallies, administration keeps saying media is the devil, media is the enemy, you know, and then depending on the media for your information at the same, I don't know if people realize that the media that they complain about and the media that they complain to is the same media.
That two standard, sorry, I'm still snotting off of just the experience of hearing the story and all this stuff hitting me, but we're going to keep it moving. That there's both a double standard, there's some hypocrisy in the mix, and then there's a circular thing that happens, right? And I have to put myself into the mindset of the folks.
There's stupidity in the mix, too.
Well, okay. I'm going to purposely not use that word, though, Flea, simply because once you start putting all these different layers in there, how do you unpack and get down? Like, to me, stupid is when you know all of the stuff, you know all the layers, and you can rationally think about all of that and still make a choice to do dumb stuff. Then, yes, I'll use that word. But what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing a cohort of folks who I actually agree with in that I don't feel like there's enough attention being put towards creatively opening and reimagining new ways of being together in commerce. That argument makes all the sense in the world. So if I'm out and I'm socially distantly saying, hey, we're not putting enough attention to this, move in this area is one thing. That unfortunately is not what I'm hearing, though. I'm hearing a lot more of, we just need to open up back up, and we're just going to dismiss and act like this stuff isn't happening seriously. That I have a huge problem with. At the same time, as you have folks who are smiling at the support of Trump and the Liberate movement, completely denying the fact that Trump is part of the folks requesting our current positioning. How can both of those things be true? You can't, you know, it's a square peg in a round hole kind of deal. And at the same time, there were folks in community who were monitoring these protests just specifically because there was a distrust of media and they wanted to gather our own stories. And you have all these other political messages being pushed, woven through on the backs of the folks who actually have a legitimate argument saying we want to see more attention towards economy opening efforts, right? So there's that nugget of truth in the mix of all of it that confuses all these things together and leaves us not being able to start to build the kind of coalitions that actually solve the issues that we're talking about. It's funny to sit back and watch kind of liberal communities and settings put mass together to a point you were making earlier, Luce, and then to see folks, conservative leading friends, doing the same work, and somehow the language that they're using is acting as if they're the only community that is doing this kind of work. So, you know, Khalid, as you bring that up, there's that confusion that puts so many layers on there that it really starts to be this confusing ball of what?
Let me say why I say stupid. Because I feel like it is so hard for me to find logic right now in a lot of the arguments that are happening, right? I mean, and I'm a person who, you know, if A plus B equals C, then you can't just make up what A or B means. So when people say like, well, we need to open the economy because I need to get my hair cut, that to me is not logical, right? Or we need to open the economy because I have to work to make money to support my family. On the other hand, you know, if your family is all sick or dying from something, what is the point of you going out making money? Or you're the one bringing that disease into the house because you insist on going out and being in public with all of these people. Does that make sense? You know, and science is logic, right?
I guess the question I'm wondering is, and I see your point, right? And it makes sense to me, and that's how I rationalize to me. I'm going to figure out the hardship in a different way to protect my family, elders, and all those kinds of things. I get that, right? I also see a space where if I was going out to work my job as a poor person supporting my family, like growing up, right? And I had to bypass or engage or put myself into a dangerous situation, either in community or the times where we've had to, my mom had to risk leaving us too young, which could have got us snatched up to go and choose and work. And we could have burned the daggone house down. There's a space where the decision is not just one or the other. It's a whole lot of complicated pieces in between. I also see the nugget of that in this as well. Even if I might rationalize and have the means to rationalize to the side of, I can figure out a way to stay home. And, you know, I still have a long way to go before we're in a situation where we're eating weenie water soup, right? For those who don't know, that's the water left over after you boil a hot dog. Like, you salt and pepper that up, you can still get some calories. So, like, I've been in that situation. I know I have a long way to go before we get there. And so I can rationalize in ways that folks who don't have that margin can't.
Well, and to further complicate this is that real leadership means we get clarity, we get plans, and we have a buy-in. We don't have that at the national level, as Don has so clearly clarified for us. I believe we do have that at the state level, at least for the state of Minnesota. But that is also contingent on all of us, each and every single one of us, adhering to the parameters and adhering to the rules. And we're not seeing that. We're not seeing that level of buy-in because folks, for whatever reason, are more interested in their own agenda. And maybe it's an issue of freedom and personal movement. I don't know. My mind doesn't go there in the same way, but that's where the slippery slope for me is, really, is we don't have that level of buy-in and community where we all are in and we're all going to follow the rules and we're all going to play by the rules so that we can all be alive when all of this is over. I reflect on the pandemic of 1918 and how that impacted our nation, where there was a false sense of security that folks could then come to gather again and resume their lifestyles, only then to be hit with another stage and losing thousands of people thereafter, and then moving on to even another stage. And none of us are scientists, and so we should all have this agreement that we should listen to those who are trained as epidemiologists and infectious disease experts, and those who are really equipped to guide us. And it's when we refuse to adhere and defer to those professional levels of guidance that we find ourselves at risk for further damage than what we're currently seeing. If we think that this is bad, it can get a lot worse when we are not adhering to the parameters that are set forth by our leaders in public policy positions.
I want to say one thing before we break. Can I say one thing before we break? What you brought up, Luz, history, and how we don't learn from history, and how we keep talking about, oh, the Spanish flu, this or that, or this that had happened in the past. There's always that second wave. And everything you say makes sense, right? We listen to the epidemiologists, we listen to the people who study this, the experts, but we don't in this country, and that's the problem. We listen to doctors who are not really doctors, you know, who have TV shows, and so people in this country believe they must be right, or believe they must have the knowledge behind this because they have a TV show. And that's the part where we're not learning from history, because we're not listening to actual professionals anymore. We're listening to people who play professionals on TV.
You're listening to Counter Stories on NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, and we've been talking this hour about coronavirus, including its impact on our personal lives. And Don, I just want to say again, our condolences on the loss of your mother. We're so sorry.
Thank you, Marianne, and thank you, Counter Stories crew. You know, I want to thank all the folks who have graciously sent their condolences. Many of you sent flowers, cards, people, you know, Anthony, other folks have reached out and offered to bring food. I mean, the outpour was tremendous. I really appreciate the support from community and from you. And while this was hard to talk about, I thought it was important. I mentioned on social media that my mother started her journey, but I didn't get into any of the details. But, you know, I felt it was important since it hit so close to home. And I pray your families and everyone else remain safe, stay home, stay safe. Take care of your loved one.
Thank you again, Don. You've been listening to Counter Stories. I'm Marianne Combs. I'm a reporter and producer for NPR News.
I'm Luz Maria Frias, CEO and founder of The Savvy Coach.
Huli Lee, owner of The Other Media Group.
Don Eubanks, associate professor and cultural consultant.
Anthony Galloway, senior partner at The Dendros Group.